After witnessing a mob hit, two male jazz musicians pose as women and quickly become involved in some complicated relationships. Listen as we chat about the art of negging, zigzag jokes, and a Marilyn Monroe song that's not Candle of the Wind. Then we find out if Some Like It Hot stands the test of time.
Time, James and Alan have their say. Do the movies you love still hold up today? James says Gladiator with a glut. Alan says as a father, blah blah. It's the test of time. James and Alan have their say. Do the movies you love still hold up today? Test of time. James and Alan have their say. Do the movies you love still hold up today?
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Test of Time. My name is Alan Noah, and I like it warm. I am joined by my co-host, James Brief. How do you like it?
Well, it depends what we're talking about, but...
No. You just have to say what you like it.
Well, I like it a little hot in the winter and cool in the summer.
All right, fine. We are going to talk about Some Like It Hot today, obviously. I had never seen this movie before. Had you seen it before?
Not only have I never seen this film before, but I don't think I've ever heard Marilyn Monroe speak before, except for that John F. Kennedy happy birthday. But I think I've only seen people kind of making a parody of it.
Okay.
So yeah, this is completely my first introduction to Marilyn.
Yeah, I had never seen a Marilyn Monroe movie. Probably people our age know her more from the pictures as opposed to the movies. But she was a major, major movie star. And I didn't know anything about this movie. I just saw that it was having its 65th anniversary. And I was like, well, that's good enough for me. I think in my head, I thought it was the one where she's on the subway grate and her skirt blows up. That's the 7-year itch. I got that wrong. Oops. But whatever. I was excited to watch a Marilyn Monroe movie. Most of what I know about her, I learned from the TV show I worked on a million years ago when Playboy ruled the world. A lot of people know that Marilyn Monroe was the very first Playboy centerfold. It wasn't even called a Playmate then. I think it was like Sweetheart of the Month or something like that. But not a lot of people know that she didn't pose for Playboy. Playboy was a brand new magazine. No one had ever heard of it. No one had ever heard of Hugh Hefner. And Hugh Hefner bought the rights to those photographs from whoever had taken those pictures years before and used them for the magazine. He didn't do anything illegal. He paid for the rights, but Marilyn Monroe did not know about it and didn't agree to it and didn't consent to it and really wasn't super thrilled that this random dude put her picture on the cover and in the magazine to sell a lot of magazines, and no one bothered to ask her.
I don't know much about her story, but very famously, she committed suicide at a young age. And from what I've gathered, I think she was treated very poorly and she was very depressed. And I read that she had an early spouse that most people don't know about in the 40s, a guy, James Doherty.
Yeah, when she was like 16, right?
Well, that was from 1942 to 1946, and she's born in 1926. Ooh.
Yeah.
Well, more famously, and I would say more appropriately, do you know her other two husbands?
Arthur Miller and...
Where have you gone?
Joe DiMaggio.
That's right. I don't know if this is apocryphal or a legend, but apparently Joe DiMaggio on his deathbed said something like, at least I'll go get to see Marilyn again. And there's a singer that I like, Darren, a friend of the show. He's a fan of him as well.
Elton John?
No, this guy, Dan Byrne.
Oh, okay.
He used to sing a song. One of the lines is, Marilyn Monroe didn't marry Henry Miller. Marilyn Monroe married Arthur Miller.
What's the name of the song?
I think it's called Marilyn Monroe.
Oh, okay. I thought you were going to say Candle in the Wind by Elton John, which is a very famous, well-known song about the death of Marilyn Monroe. But you went in a different direction.
No, I did not. Actually, the song is called Marilyn.
We should talk about the real life Marilyn Monroe stuff that went on with this movie. Apparently, Marilyn Monroe was really bad at acting during this movie. There's a story that one time she had to deliver the line, "It's me, sugar," and it took her 47 takes to get it right because she kept saying, "It's sugar, me, it's sugar." She just couldn't get those three words right in the right order. And Billy Wilder hated her. He had worked with her before, but he said he was never going to work with her again. He had a rap party after the movie was done at his mansion. He didn't invite Marilyn Monroe. He said that she cost them millions of dollars, or maybe $500,000. She cost them a lot of money because she was constantly late. She never knew her lines. Tony Curtis apparently said kissing her was like kissing Hitler because she was so hated on set. And it sounds awful at first when you hear these stories, but then you hear kind of more about the context and what was going on. And she was addicted to pills. She was trying to be taken seriously as an actor. She had this acting coach who was there who she was just enthralled by and was giving her notes. Her husband, Arthur Miller, was on set, who was also giving notes to her and to Billy Wilder, and nobody wanted him around. And it was this really stressful situation. Also then, apparently, she had a relationship with Tony Curtis years and years before this movie. They kind of had a fling when they were young actors starting off in Hollywood. They broke up. They went their separate ways. She's married to Arthur Miller, who's on set, and according to Tony Curtis, they had an affair while they were making this movie. She gets pregnant under the nose of her husband. Then they have to tell Arthur Miller that she's pregnant. And then she later has a miscarriage. So she was going through a lot. And so all of the, oh, she's so difficult, oh, she's like Hitler stuff, like when you hear all of that other context, you're like, okay, maybe cut the woman some slack. Also knowing the end of her story when she dies of an overdose just a couple years later, you got to be a little forgiving in these stories.
There's so much about Marilyn Monroe that people have either gotten wrong, or including myself. I had thought one of those really interesting facts was that Marilyn Monroe was actually a size 16. Have you heard that before?
Maybe. That sounds vaguely familiar.
So as I'm doing some research, apparently it was like a UK size, and those sizes were totally different. But apparently she was more of like a size 6 or 8. Like,
okay.
So that makes more sense. But there was this movie last year or 2 years ago with Ana de Armas, Blonde.
Yeah.
And I don't know anything about it, but I mean, I think she was nominated for something, for an award, Anna. But apparently the movie, people were trashing it as fake, and it's based off of another biography about her, which I guess apparently that's totally wrong. And this is not some king of Assyria that we just don't know much about. This is one of the most photographed women of the 1950s, probably most interviewed. There's got to be tons of Time and Life magazine, all these things. And it's just amazing how many myths are out there about her that are just totally wrong.
That's true. That's a very good point. I remember when that movie came out, Blonde. At first, I was like, oh, that'll be really interesting. And then it started just getting dragged as being inaccurate and exploitative. And I was like, okay, now I'm not interested anymore. So I never watched it. I think it was like a made for Netflix movie, if I'm remembering.
It was some. It wasn't in the theaters, I don't think.
Yeah.
But in case you're like Alan and I and you haven't seen this film, Some Like It Hot takes place during Prohibition in 1929, and it follows two jazz musicians, Joe and Jerry, who witness a St. Valentine's Day massacre, like mob attack in Chicago. To escape, they disguise themselves as women and join an all-female jazz band. Joe becomes Josephine, and Jerry assumes the name Daphne. On the train to a gig in Florida, they meet Sugarcane, played by Marilyn Monroe. Sugarcane is the band's ukulele player and singer. Both Joe and Jerry are interested in Sugar, but she treats them both as girlfriends. Sugar confides to Josephine that she hopes to marry a millionaire, so when they get to Florida, Joe adopts another persona, Junior, an oil tycoon. Junior is everything Sugar wants, and she quickly falls for him. Meanwhile, Daphne is pursued by another millionaire named Osgood. At first, Daphne rebuffs Osgood, but when he proposes, Daphne accepts. But these romances hit a snag when the Chicago gangsters arrive in Florida and realize that Josephine and Daphne are really the men who witnessed the murder they committed back home. Ultimately, the men come clean about their deception, and both Sugar and Osgood accept them for who they really are.
Right. So this movie came out 65 years ago. How did it do when it came out? It had to have been a hit with Marilyn Monroe in it.
Yes, this was a smash hit. It wound up making $25 million in the U.S. It cost millions to make, but it was a huge hit. It was the number 3 film of 1959. And we have not done either of these films, but I'm going to see if you can guess, because these are films, at least the first one, it really might be worth watching and seeing if it still holds up. It's usually kind of told as a Christian allegory film. It takes place in ancient Rome, and it's most famous for having a very famous chariot race.
Ben-Hur?
Ben-Hur, that's right.
Okay.
The second film, I don't know much about it. All I know is that Tim Allen did a remake of this film, and I think a person turns into a dog.
I have no idea.
I think that's what the Shaggy Dog is. Okay. So those are the first two films, and Someone Like It Hot was number three. And this is actually the second highest grossing American film ever released in the Soviet Union.
Really?
Yeah. Someone Like It Hot was number two. The first film, the plot is very different, but it's also a very famous ancient Rome film.
Spartacus?
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. Yeah. So this film was, I would say, not only a smash, but one of these worldwide smashes because the Soviet Union let it in.
That's interesting, but also I buy it. Marilyn Monroe, beautiful, whether you're an American or a Russian or any nationality, she's just a gorgeous woman. And she was putting butts in seats, I guess. So good for her. While doing some research about this movie, I found out about this thing called the Hays Code. Did you see this?
No.
Okay, so the real official title for it was the Motion Picture Production Code, better known as the Hays Code. But it was basically this self-censorship thing that the movie industry had adopted before there were MPAA ratings. And it was very Christian. And the reason it came up in my research about this movie is because Some Like It Hot was not registered with the Hays Code because it featured cross-dressing. And the Hays Code had a lot of things that you couldn't do and that you should be careful. There were don'ts and be carefuls. The don'ts included profanity, which included SOB, hell, God, things like that. Any kind of nudity, childbirth, ridicule of the clergy, miscegenation, any inference of sex perversion. Back then, that included homosexuality, that included cross-dressing. So this movie was definitely, definitely not allowed. Some of the be carefuls are the use of the flag, the use of firearms, smuggling, a sedition, sympathy for criminals. It's laughable. It's laughable from a 2024 point of view, but this movie was too scandalous for this Hays Code. It was also banned in Kansas. It was condemned by the Catholic Church. And it's all kind of funny because it's so tame by today's standards. But this was a really, really big deal back then.
You know, it's interesting you say that, and I was going to bring it up eventually, but there have been cross-dressing stories throughout history. I mean, Shakespeare has a ton of them, and this film is very Shakespeare-like. And Mulan, the climax is cross-dressing. The whole film is cross-dressing, basically. Yeah. And I feel like people were kind of sensible 20 years ago. You know, there used to be kind of fun, let's have fun. You know, the boys dress as girls dress as boys for Halloween or Purim or whatever. And I feel like today this film would be, oh my God, this is advancing the transgender agenda. When of course, it's completely nothing to do with it. But I just watched this film thinking, oh my God, the radical Christian right would absolutely go crazy against this film.
It's interesting because there was some concern about making this movie. There was concern from Tony Curtis, who was, kind of a macho man's man, and he's going to wear a dress? Is that okay? But apparently he was very good friends with Rock Hudson, and he didn't really mind. And I was expecting, quite frankly, this movie to be worse and more offensive. And it really isn't. At its core, the joke is, LOL, these are men dressed as women. And a lot of that humor does feel eye roll worthy to me, at least. And not even that, like, oh, it's problematic. Also, I just don't think it's all that funny. But the movie is actually fairly progressive in the way that it sort of plays with gender. Here's the best example of that. When the men are dressed as women and they're on the train, all of the women just accept them. They're friends with them. They don't care. And maybe it's because their disguises are so great and you know, they're just fooled. That's sort of what the movie is implying. Or you could look at it from a more modern lens of maybe they figure, okay, these are transgender women and they're here in our all women's band and neat, nice to meet you. None of that is said explicitly, of course, because that wasn't done in 1959, but you could look at it as they're instantly accepted as women and no one gives a shit.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
And I'm sure we'll revisit the gender stuff. I did think that the way this movie opened was very interesting with this mafia scene. There's a speakeasy. Actually, before they even get to the speakeasy, there's a hearse that's driving by, and then the cops try to pull it over, and the hearse speeds away, and then the cops immediately open fire on this like random street. I'm like, that seems weird, but it's not an actual hearse. They're bootleggers. They go to the speakeasy and they don't serve alcohol, only coffee. Wink, wink. Like, it's silly. Like, it's meant to be silly. The guy who runs the front of the funeral parlor is named Mr. Mozzarella. So, you know, it's clearly leaning hard into the Italian stereotypes.
Well, I'll tell you this. My last big relationship was with, she was partly Italian-American, and I learned something when I was dating her. Italian is one of the last things that people will openly make fun of. You wouldn't say anything about black people or Jewish people, or you wouldn't make a stereotype about them. But I feel like people still do that. Maybe a little more kind of like the Jersey Shore thing, but I feel like people still say it. In this film, the mob guys that meet at the end, like their association is the meeting of the Italian opera singers. Like it's all Italian equals mob, Italian equals mafia. And that's definitely outdated.
Right. But it takes a while before all of the cross-dressing stuff to even happen. There's a lot of world building about these criminals and Spats Columbo and these guys who are in this jazz band and they have money troubles and they're borrowing money and then they witness the murder and then they get to the train when they're in the dresses and everything. They build to that. There is a lot of that mafia stuff that happens in the beginning.
I did think that there was a while before we met Marilyn Monroe. There was definitely filler in this film that they could have cut.
Yeah. The person who I like in this story is the cop. The cop, I think, is just very deadpan and dry, and he's busting up the speakeasy. And when he's talking to Spats Columbo, they're kind of back and forth rat-a-tat dialogue. I like that. That, I think, is funny. Spats, when he's like with the other mobsters, I was just rolling my eyes. At the massacre scene, one of the guys, I forget who it is, they say, oh, don't worry, we won't breathe a word. And he says, you won't breathe nothing, you know, because he's threatening him, he's going to kill him. But then he follows it up with, not even air. Like, right, no, we got that when you said you won't breathe nothing. And yeah, at the end, when the mob stuff comes back in, I get it. You kind of need that tension for Act 3 and raising the stakes and then there are witnesses to another murder. But at the end, I thought it was way, way worse. It bothered me more at the end than it did at the beginning, mainly because I didn't know what this movie was about. I didn't do any research. You know, when I pulled it up on Max, I saw the picture of the men in drag, but I didn't really know what to expect. So I was just along for the ride in the beginning. And then when it all came back at the end, I was like, oh, we're doing this again.
Yeah, I didn't know this was a cross-dressing film either, but it's very Shakespearean, very Midsummer Night's Dream, As You Like It, where they go into the forest and then they disguise themselves as something else, but then the wrong person falls in love with the wrong person in the love triangle, and it all works out in the end. But this film really reminded me of Wedding Crashers.
Okay.
So this is a film where two guys are disguising themselves as fake people. Yeah. And they both fall in love with women who are in love with their fake personas. And there's a lot of tension. Will they or won't they get caught? And in the end, they do get caught and the women forgive them.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, it's an old story, the Shakespearean things. Cross-dressing is a very old story used for many years when usually people had no problem with this.
Right. Like you said, in Shakespeare, right? Back then, men played all of the roles, even the female roles, because of sexism. And, you know, it was deemed that women weren't good enough to play women and only men could play women. I also wonder if part of that was sexism and part of that was maybe just some of those men wanted to dress up as women and kiss other men, which is fine, but they didn't have to hide behind sexism as the reason to do that. But I guess we're going back hundreds of years, so I shouldn't wag my finger at them for not being so progressive. When they're on the train and they are trying to pass as women and it's working, they're both competing for Sugar's attention. Because, of course, they're both enamored with her. She's gorgeous. Sugar climbs into Daphne's bunk, and then they have, like, this whole party, and then it's kind of funny because there's a million women in this one tiny little cramped space. As soon as Sugar kind of comes in there, Jerry, as Daphne, is thrilled. He's so excited that she's there. All I was thinking was, oh, my God, I would be petrified. What if I get a boner? Which I definitely would if Marilyn Monroe was in my cot. So that would be a problem, you know, for him. I like these scenes. I like everything on the train when Sugar is kind of confessing everything to Josephine about what she's looking for and how she wants a millionaire and all of that. I'm like, this is gonna bite her in the ass, you know, metaphorically speaking. And it does when Joe takes on this other persona when he becomes Junior, the millionaire. Again, wasn't expecting that twist. You know, I was expecting it to be more of he's in drag for the whole movie. Not that he then goes back to being a man, but he's impersonating a different man. And now he's got another character and making it even more confusing. And he's in a love triangle with himself kind of a deal. Everything with Junior to me was just like icky because he is using the knowledge that he got from the train. When Sugar confided in Josephine, then Joe uses to trick her. And then at the end, she forgives him and they're a happy couple anyway. And that I did see coming. I was like, okay, eventually that's where this story is going, that she'll forgive him and, they'll ride off into the sunset together. I mean, it is manipulative and it felt manipulative and icky to me.
You know, the manipulation, I don't know why, I just kept going to Wedding Crashers when I was watching this film. They're basically two jerks that crash weddings. They make up fake personas to try to sleep with women. They, you know, eventually learn to be better. But in this film, at least there's no bad motive for these guys trying to be women. I mean, they're trying to escape the mob.
Yeah.
So that's fine. And, you know, meeting Marilyn, I mean, you can't help but fall in love with her, I guess. You know, she's so beautiful and she's so nice to them. But the problem that I have is, why are they trying here? They're trying to escape the mob. Yeah. I mean, to bring up another film that is similar plot, but maybe I'll make you review this film one day. But Big Mama's House.
Oh, God.
Well, that's another one where Martin Lawrence plays a woman, a Big Mama in that film.
Yeah.
But every time Big Mama sees a beautiful woman, you know, Martin Lawrence gets very horny. And it's like, you're supposed to be undercover, just keep it in your pants for a moment.
Right.
In this film, Some Like It Hot, you're trying to escape like the 1929 Chicago mob.
Right.
I mean, this is the scariest of the scary. I mean, at least back then.
Sure.
And, you know, maybe just lay low and get off the train and ditch this band. That's what I would do.
While we're just throwing random movie references around, I think it's a Something About Mary kind of situation. And you buy that with Marilyn Monroe. They see her and they instantly fall for her and they will do anything to be with her. And in 1959, the shitty manipulation of her wants and desires that was told in confidence. Yeah. We're just going to use that for comedy. Junior scores a date on this yacht with Sugar. And when they first meet on the beach, he's putting her down, I'll use his first name only. There was a guy in our fraternity named Brian. You know exactly who I'm talking about. He was always talking about how to pick up girls, and he was always talking about negging. You remember that?
I didn't talk to him much.
You're much better off. The idea of negging was that if you are interested in a girl and let her know that you're interested in her, she will not be interested in you. The only way to make a girl like you is to be mean to her and treat her like shit, according to this one scumbag. And it's kind of a school of thought said with big, giant fucking air quotes. I think it was like a how to be a player, maybe.
Well, I mean, if you like a girl at a bar and you completely fawn over her, I agree, don't do that. But I would do the whole play it cool, dude. But the be an asshole to her, I've definitely heard that strategy. And
yeah,
it'll pick up a certain kind of woman. But
right.
I believe in the play it cool, dude. Play it cool, you know, when you meet her, you know, a few minutes later, say, hey, I'll check you out at the party a little later. And then come back 10 minutes later. But I can see that guy from our fraternity maybe said that. But not the best strategy. But it does kind of seem like that's what Junior's doing here.
Oh, yeah, 100%. He is an out-and-out asshole. It totally works. Then they get on this yacht, and she is into him. She is on top of him, and he's saying, no, no, I can't because I had this other great love, and she died, and I can never be with another woman ever again. I don't understand the construct of that at all. She's into you. You want her. Go for it. It's not even just that he has to make her want it. He makes her beg for it and really, really work hard. Was that supposed to be funny as that went on and on and on?
I feel like he was also kind of implying to her that he's impotent. But I also couldn't quite understand what the point of that was, because I feel like that might be a not the best thing to plant.
Sure, absolutely. And at a certain point, like, she is lying on top of him, making out with him. And if he's pretending to be impotent, sorry to keep bringing up boners, but she's gonna notice if he is erect, right? So what's the point? I just felt like that went on too long, even though some parts of that scene were pretty funny, where there's a swordfish hanging on the wall and he calls it a herring, and the delicacy that they're eating on the boat is cold pheasant, which sounds fucking awful. I don't know if that was a big delicacy in 1929. Sounds fucking disgusting.
I mean, I've read about how food in America, apparently before our lifetime, was very, very bland. Like, things like garlic and things were seen as foreign spices. And I heard that in the 50s and earlier, things were very bland. It was like the 60s, 70s, they started doing more flavoring and embracing, oh, Chinese food, this could be cool. And, you know, other flavors and soy and ginger and, you know, all these things. That's what I've read. So I wouldn't be surprised if kind of the delicacies back then were, you know, bleh.
I guess. But let's talk about the other relationship in the movie between Daphne and Osgood. Daphne is also Jerry, just in drag. And Osgood is this guy at the hotel who's a real millionaire, unlike Junior, who's a fake millionaire. And he is very handsy right out of the gate with Daphne. And they go on their own date while Sugar and Junior are making out on the yacht. And Osgood proposes to Daphne, and Daphne accepts. Do you remember what Joe says when he hears that they're engaged?
I mean, he says something like, you can't marry him.
Right. But then he says, why would any man marry a man?
Oh, yeah.
And that bothers me. I felt like that line really kind of crystallized this movie's entire sort of philosophy, which is that gay people don't exist. Did you have that thought?
No, I caught that line the same as you, but I was like, that doesn't hold up. But I didn't think it like that. For example, Osgood, this guy, he's kind of seen as kind of harmless. He's just in love with Daphne. He really likes her and wants to marry her. But you said earlier, he's kind of handsy with her. You could also say he assaults her many times. I mean, he grabs her. You know,
sure.
The point being, I don't think the writers in 1959 were trying to portray Osgood as a bad guy. I think he is genuinely, he's into Daphne. I think the most famous line of this entire film counteracts your thesis. This film does not say gay people don't exist. Do you know what the most famous line of this film is? It's on director Billy Wilder's tombstone.
Yes, the final line of the movie when Daphne is trying to tell Osgood, we can't get married for this reason, that reason, that reason, that reason. And Osgood doesn't give a shit. And then finally he pulls off the wig and says, I'm a man. And Osgood shrugs and says, nobody's perfect. That acknowledges that he's okay being in a relationship with a man, but the entire rest of the movie before the very last two words has this ethos of gay people don't exist.
You know, in a weird way, I would say I agree that gay people don't exist in this film, but I don't think they're saying it like they don't exist. I just think it's like also Macedonia doesn't exist in this film. They just don't talk about it.
But when he says, why would any man marry a man? The response is security, which is a joke. I get it. Ha ha ha. But I feel like there's a way to respond to that in a comic way, which is just be like, well, we work in the entertainment industry. I know plenty of men who'd want to marry another man. Just acknowledge that gay people exist. Do it in a comic way. Do it in a way that makes sense for the universe. That one line really pissed me off. And no, that sentence does not stand the test of time.
Yeah, I just didn't see it that way. I think you might be seeing it a little bit too much through a 2024 lens, which I, again, agree with it. I just don't think that was what they were going for at all.
Oh, no. They definitely were not going for that. And going back to that last line of the movie, the construct of that joke, I think, is really smart. And I was listening to some podcast where they were talking about it. But basically what they were saying was the audience expects that when he confesses, I'm a man, that Osgood is going to flip out. He's going to have a really, really extreme reaction. What? Are you kidding me? Huh? It's joke construction. You're expecting the zig. And so they give you the zag. Instead of the big reaction, you get a very muted response. And that's funny because it's unexpected. It works. Like, I understand why they pick that punchline. And also, apparently, that punchline was an early draft and it was a placeholder and it was going to be replaced as soon as they come up with something better. And they never did. And they left it in. And now it has become like one of the best lines ever. And people have it on these lists of it's the most memorable thing. I mean, when I first watched the movie and I heard him say that, I was like, oh, I didn't think it was awful or brilliant. I was just kind of like, oh, I get it. I was surprised that it's such a beloved line.
Well, to be fair, Al, you love the zigzag joke.
Sure.
You, for 25 years that I've known you, you would say something like, man, that was such a thriller. Just like that Michael Jackson song, Black
Beat
or
it.
White.
Oh, okay.
Exactly.
Yes. I mean, I could really nerd out on joke construction and I won't, I promise. That would be boring. But I get it. I appreciate it. I just don't think Nobody's Perfect is that iconic.
Do you know what I thought of when I heard the iconic Nobody's Perfect line, which I didn't know was a line from this film?
No, what were you thinking of?
I'll give you a hint. This is episode 403. We heard this line in a film 403 episodes ago.
Independence Day?
That's right. It's a line that I remember the whole theater laughing out loud. So people must love this line.
When do they say it in Independence Day?
All right, so at the very end, Judd Hirsch brings everyone around and says, hey, come here, let's pray. And he's saying, Baruch atah Adonai, and one of the guys goes, oh, I shouldn't sit here, I'm not Jewish. And Judd Hirsch goes, nobody's perfect.
Oh, okay.
Now I realize it's a reference to one of the most famous films ever, but I had no idea when I saw this film in 1996, and I had no idea until last night.
Okay.
Well, you know, the other incredibly iconic part of this film, she does this song, I Want to Be Loved by You. And, you know, it's, I want to be loved by you, boop, boop, ba-doop. I mean, I've never seen it, but I feel like I've seen it. you know, I must have just seen it in parodies because it was so deja vu that I've seen this before.
Well, the Boop Boop Bidoo makes me think of Betty Boop. And I don't know which came first, this movie or Betty Boop singing Boop Boop Bidoo.
It's got to be Betty Boop first, right?
I mean, I would think so because she's black and white and this movie's black and white, but there were color movies at this time. The reason that this movie was black and white was because when Jack Lemmon and Tony Curtis wore the makeup, apparently they looked ghoulish and green. So that's why they did it black and white. And Marilyn Monroe had a clause in her contract that she would not do black and white movies. She would only do color movies. But they convinced her when they showed the screen tests and they looked gross in the makeup.
I was thinking that the black and white worked very well here because I was thinking exactly that. The men dressed as women, they looked somewhat like a lot more convincing than, say, Mrs. Doubtfire. And I was thinking it was because of the black and white. Because try taking photographs in black and white on your phone. Not only does it look kind of artsy, but it flushes out a lot of blemishes on people's faces. I'm telling you, I think people look a lot better in black and white a lot of times. Not always, but in a case like this, I thought the black and white really, really made them look a lot better. And I thought it was on purpose, but that totally makes sense.
Well, yeah, I mean, it is on purpose. I mean, that was why they did it. Also, apparently there was a female impersonator, a famous female impersonator that they hired to help Jack Lemmon and Tony Curtis act and look and walk more like women. But I forget which one, if it was Jack Lemmon or Tony Curtis. They said, no, we don't want that because we don't want to look like women. We want to look like men trying to look like women. So it has to be a little off and not quite correct. And actually, when they see Marilyn Monroe for the first time in the train station, yes, they are blown away by how beautiful she is. But I think it's Daphne who says, you know, just look at how she walks. How does she do it? It's not even just lust and attraction. It's also just appreciation of how she walks that way. You know, it's like, huh, that's really interesting. And you know, he never had to think about the way that women walk before he was impersonating a woman to save his life. So it makes sense. Random question. Have you ever gotten dressed up as a woman, like for Halloween or anything?
Trying to think. No, I don't think I have.
Okay. I mean, I told you about last Halloween when I was Nicole Kidman years and years and years ago with my buddy Clint, who joined us for Conan the Barbarian. He and I got dressed up as women on Halloween. He was a French maid and I was a Hooters girl. And, you know, just to be clear, we weren't doing it in a mocking way. It was Halloween. We were just having fun. I remember from that experience thinking, oh my God, is this what it's like to be a woman? Because anytime I was talking to a guy, they were staring at my chest. And it was the fake boobs I bought at Spencer's Gifts for, you know, $4.99 or something. And, you know, guys knew that, but they were still just staring at my fake boobs. And I was like, do I do this when I talk to women? This is awful. And that also comes into play in this movie that they realize, God, it's hard being a woman.
Probably the answer is yes, Al, you do it. And yes, the women notice it. So I think that's what probably the thing that opened your eyes to it.
Yeah. No, definitely. It was an eye-opening experience.
You know, there's one line in this film. I don't know whether it's a mistake, whether it's supposed to be funny, or whether it's supposed to show Candy is kind of stupid.
You mean Sugar?
Yeah, Candy. Sorry, her name is Sugar Cane.
What's the difference?
But she sees Junior, the millionaire's, she thinks it's his boat, but it's really Osgood's boat. And she sees all these jewels and diamonds. And she goes, real diamonds? Wow, they must be worth their weight in gold. And I just thought that was a very funny line.
I wonder if that's a reference to Diamonds or A Girl's Best Friend. Wasn't that a Marilyn Monroe song?
Maybe.
Because when she's walking on the train platform, that scene I was talking about before, the steam kind of blows out at her. And that's kind of a callback to the 7-year itch when the steam blows up her dress. So
also Billy Wilder.
Right. Exactly. Also, by the way, I didn't realize that it was really Marilyn Monroe singing in this movie. It is. I wasn't sure if it was dubbed or not. I just didn't know. I mean, like you were saying before about never having heard her voice other than Happy Birthday, Mr. President. I had no idea. But yes, it was, in fact, Marilyn Monroe really singing in this movie. But James, what do you think about Some Like It Hot? Do you think the movie stands the test of time?
There's flaws with this film. One, it's too long. Probably more kind of the gags that don't really advance the plot, or that are just kind of another will they find out? No, they won't find out. That part drags a little bit. And it is a little bit confusing who some of the characters are, especially on the train. I thought I confused some of the women that were not Marilyn Monroe. It's an old trope. It's a love triangle, or in this case, not quite a triangle, but cross-dressing and falling in love with the other one. And then it all works out in the end. And as I mentioned, it reminds me of a lot of films and other movies and plays that I've seen. This is known as one of the American classics. I get why it was a big hit back then. I enjoyed it today. I will say it stands the test of time. It's a little simpler 50s film, not too difficult. It was an enjoyable film for me. Yeah, some parts that don't stand up. But the ending actually is very different than I thought it would be. The zag there, I really thought that Osgood would say, "What a man, aye, aye, aye," and jump out of the boat or something. But nobody's perfect. The end, and it's kind of that fun dun, 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 ending where everyone's happy, and I feel like everyone walked out of the theater happy in 1959. I was happy when I watched it yesterday, so I'm going to say yes, it stands the test of time. What about you, Dal? Does this film stand the test of time?
I said this earlier. I was expecting this movie to be worse. I thought maybe there were going to be a lot of horrible, horrific, homophobic jokes, and there aren't. There's a lot of sympathy towards these women and you know, the men understanding what women go through. I think at one point Daphne even's like, "I don't understand why Osgood likes me." And Josephine or Junior or whoever it is at that moment says, "They don't care, just as long as you're in a skirt." It's like, yeah, like they're making commentary about how difficult it is to be a woman. And this movie was really, really progressive 65 years ago. It is credited for initiating some conversations about gay people and men who dress as women and things like that, which were very, very taboo. It was banned in Kansas and, you know, condemned by the Catholic Church and all of those things. But it still just feels dated to me. There is a musical on Broadway now, this year, called Some Like It Hot. It's inspired by this movie. And I was thinking, you know what? I would bet lots and lots and lots of money that in that musical, they do not do the thing that the movie does, where it basically ignores the existence of gay people. I would bet that somewhere in that musical, there is a gay character or gay characters. Maybe there's someone who's non-binary or transgender. And I was curious about it. As I'm making this mental bet with myself, I looked it up, and yes, in fact, one of the actors in that musical was the first ever non-binary actor to win a Tony, and the character of, I think it's Daphne, in the musical, at the end of the story, realizes that they are non-binary. That is great, and that is what you would expect from a story like this in 2024. And the movie version isn't like that. So I think that the movie doesn't stand the test of time. And it's the opposite of what we said last week about how Do the Right Thing stands the test of time and you wish it didn't. You know, if only racism and police brutality had gone away, that would be better for the world. I think the fact that we are having these conversations now is a great, wonderful thing for the world. And this movie is credited for initiating some of those conversations. Wonderful. Even still, though, looking at the movie itself, it doesn't stand the test of time because it just feels like, why aren't they ever acknowledging any of these things? I know why, but it still feels weird. Also, there is a kiss when Josephine kisses Sugar, and that is kind of a lesbian kiss, not really, but that was also a big deal and very scandalous at the time. You really don't see anything. It's like the back of her head. It's not like, you know, you really see what appears to be two women kissing, just the way the shot is framed. It's not what you would expect today. Also, the entire character of the bellhop who is saying that he's going to break into the women's room. Don't worry, I have my own key. I'll just let myself in while you're in bed. And then he does it? Like, that's a joke in 1959. It doesn't read the same way today. Oh, this is a very small detail, but when Osgood proposes to Daphne, he gives her a bracelet, not a diamond ring. And, you know, he's a millionaire. He can afford a diamond ring. I was just wondering if, like, when the De Beers company made diamond rings be the engagement thing, I'm assuming that happened after 59. I didn't bother to Google it, so I don't know. But that kind of leapt out at me as a test of time thing. But that's a small detail. I enjoyed this movie. I'm very glad that I watched it. I'm down to watch more Billy Wilder movies, more Marilyn Monroe movies, Tony Curtis, Jack Lemmon, all of them. I like this movie. I enjoyed watching it. And I'm glad that it doesn't stand the test of time. I think that is a good thing for the world and society.
I see what you're seeing. You know, I didn't read into it as much as you, but, you know, we see it differently. Such is art, Alan.
That's true. And I mean, I'm only saying this from a test of time perspective. Also, saying a movie doesn't stand the test of time, I get it. It's a no, but it can be a good thing. It can be fine. Billy Wilder isn't spinning in his grave. He doesn't give a shit what I say, I'm sure. But I think Billy Wilder and the people who made this movie, in spite of the Hays Code and all of this other stuff, good for them. Well done. But that's going to do it for us this week. Next week, we're going to be talking about a movie that's been on the list for a while, Romancing the Stone. I don't really know anything about it other than I think it's an Indiana Jones kind of ripoff. Is that right?
I believe it's correct. I definitely saw it back in the day, but I don't remember anything about it. But I remember back in the 80s, there were a lot of Indiana Jones ripoffs.
Right. The following week, we'll do the sequel, The Jewel of the Nile. Haven't seen that one either.
So we're getting two Danny DeVito films in a row, so that's great.
Oh, I didn't know Danny DeVito was in it.
There you go.
Well, I'm looking forward to that. Make sure you don't miss those episodes by subscribing on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google, whatever app you use. Write to us at Test of Time Pod on Facebook, X, Instagram, and Threads. And we'll see you next time, everybody.
Bye.